Guards opened the year by taking 3 out of 4 against the Athletics. Zach was there, as you can see, and come to think of it, that makes him one of the rarest people in the world.
You're listening to the Selfie Is Godcast with Zach Meisel and TJ Zuppi.
Fly ball, deep right field. Back is Spencer at the one and track at the wall.
Subscribe to Selfie Is Godcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Unbelievable.
I can't get over the visual. If you're not watching this on YouTube, you're missing out. You are going to miss Zach Meisel get assaulted by a bird. You're going to miss it. Are you fearful for your life?
I just feel like a on-site news reporter reporting live from the land of seagulls. I'm Zach Meisel, Channel 3.
Oh, this is going to end up on some viral clip after you get attacked. You are going to get attacked.
Well, I think the seagulls are circling because I'm standing in the booth that was once home to some possums. So it's all critters are welcome here.
Us included. Welcome to the show. It's the Selby Is Godcast. I'm TJ. That's Zach Meisel. He's on location. He was in Oakland. You know, it became a running gag so much last year that they would have a really bad weekend. And just before we were going to sit down and do a show, it'd have a really good finale. And so it sort of took the edge off a little bit, became just this joke. Every series, they'd lose the first two, they'd have a great third game. You can't really come on here and blast them. I'm hopeful that today is an indication that we're going to get a flip of that, which I will deal with. If you give me 3 great games and 1 not so great game, 1 that Oakland tried to give away in the finale and you didn't take it, but you still leave Oakland a place that has become a real bad place for Cleveland baseball teams over the past decade plus. I'll take that. Open the season. It's real tough to take 4 games in any part of the schedule, even a team like Oakland. But you are there. You, as I said, were part of the hundreds and hundreds of fans in attendance. What were some of your takeaways from opening weekend?
Well, I certainly don't blame the fans here, because this has been just a terrible situation, and I mean, you look at the names on the roster, you look at the payroll, and it's not just this season, this isn't new, but this has not been a team that is in competition. This is not an ownership group that has tried to put the best team on the field in order to build a winner. This is an organization that has had their 1 foot out the door now for years, so it's disappointing. It was cool to see the rallies going on outside the stadium Thursday night. And, you know, it was more subdued than I thought, especially inside the park, where I think the general consensus, and this doesn't speak for everybody, but this is such a foregone conclusion at this point, it seems like, that I think a lot of fans are just defeated. So it's hard. I mean, you look around the ballpark and you see an homage to Ricky Henderson or Dave Stewart or Catfish Hunter or so many other greats who have played here, and you think about all the history of the franchise, and to just have that ripped away sucks. And then you think about the storylines, and like Stephen Vogt has nothing but awesome things to say about this place and the fans and the building, and it was a weird weekend. It's crazy that it wound up where he's back in Oakland to start things and then going to go to Seattle, where he's lived for a long time, and where he coached last year. But just like everything going on, I just felt like there were a billion storylines, and then Bieber looks like Bieber the first game, and the offense looks like the 2022 offense when it was at its highest level of functionality. So many storylines, and it was one weekend. I mean, it's crazy. It feels like there are a billion things to talk about. I don't even know where to start.
There really are. I'm thinking of, and you are obviously in these locker rooms to ask these sorts of questions, but we talk about The adrenaline being there, whether it's for an opener, but even just an average baseball game compared to what you're doing in spring training. We'd say, a guy's fastball will tick up maybe half a tick because you're in a real game. You're on a major league mound in a major league stadium with fans screaming at you for good or for bad. And yet that wasn't the case this weekend. It had to feel almost like an extension of what they were already doing in spring training in some regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone has pretty clearly defined who we think the worst teams in the league are going to be, right? Oakland, White Sox, Rockies. Am I missing anyone? I mean, that feels like a pretty safe bet that those will be three of the five worst teams, if not the worst three. And, man, the A's, they did everything. It felt like they had money on the Guardians on Sunday. Once Paul Blackburn left the game.
It's not a time to make those jokes.
Okay.
Not a time to make those jokes.
But, okay, they're interpreters. but the games do count. And even though the Coliseum is sparsely filled, there were a lot of Guardians players' family members here. And they were all sitting behind the dugout. And I think whether you're Cade Smith walking off the mound for the first time, yeah, and making eye contact with your parents and siblings and wife, whether you're Kwan, who was playing in front of family, whether you're Vogt and your dad's here and your wife and kids are here. And I think it felt real to them. I think from our standpoint, it's like, all right, you took 3 or 4 from Oakland. You should do that. It's confirming of some good things. Like, it's great to see Tyler Freeman play well, to see Andrés Giménez hit the ball, to see Jose Ramirez hit a home run.
We'll get to that.
But I'm saying it is weird when you're in Arizona, you start on the West Coast, and you're playing in a building where the focus, the main line of questioning throughout the weekend had nothing to do with the Guardians. It had to do with the manager's return, had to do with the situation with the franchise. So I do think maybe it'll be Seattle where starts to feel a little more real, and then Minnesota will probably feel a little more real than that, and then you'll come home and you'll have a really weird day where you take batting practice super early because the moon and the sun have to do their thing, and then I think it'll start to actually feel like you're in the throes of the season.
So you want to be a first-time major league manager, huh? Let's start there. We really could start with a number of different things, but some of the moves that he made in the finale sort of stood out. We can get into those a little bit in a few minutes. But I'm just curious from your perspective, first time Stephen Vogt's doing this in a real game, post-game setting. Did he look like he's done it a lot before? Just looking in the dugout, he carries himself like he looks like he's been doing this for several years. He already has the manager look. He's got the manager coat, which, God, that thing is awesome. And our fans were sharing that, and our listeners were sharing that in the Discord. And I looked at it, it's like $150. I'm like, wait, what? For a coat? No, I'm not spending that amount of money. But it looked really cool on Stephen Vogt. Did it look seamless after the game when he's handling his pre and post games? Is he comfortable in those settings, or can you already maybe tell a little bit that he's nervous? This is still his first time going around here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what we've said all along, that he's got the communication stuff down, right? He knows how to build relationships. I think the thing that probably stuck out to the Guardians the most is he cares about the right things. And so when that's the case, that makes everything easier, right? Tito's players knew that he cared about them so much and was going to do everything he could to put them in the right positions to succeed and have their backs. And I think that's Vogt. I mean, yeah, he seems comfortable. I was curious to see just after his first loss, is he really short? Is he grumpy? He was the same guy. And you want to be even keeled. You want to treat every day the same and flush it and move on to the next day. So, you know, there's a lot I think we learned. I think we need to see more evidence before we can maybe confirm some things, whether it's how he wants to structure a lineup, getting guys in every day or two.
Right.
He said he hates the word platoon, doesn't believe in personal catchers. I think we've noticed he's more aggressive of a manager. We've seen some early pinch hits. Even though the squeeze play didn't work on Sunday, he said it himself, like, it's It's an aggressive move, and if it works, it looks great, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. So we need to see more, for sure. But all the reasons why they fell for him so quickly, I think, have played out so far. And the main thing is going to be, I mean, it's easy when you're winning. And you can say through the first series, like, this looks like a tight-knit team, and they look like they're one step ahead, and things are going well, and that's fine. I think what's going to tell us a lot is when this team really hits a snag, and how does he operate in that medium? You know, when they get swept on the road, when they lose five in a row, is he pulling the right levers? What does he believe in those moments? Because, again, a lot of this is he may have principles he thinks he believes in, but until that moment strikes and you have to lean on those, you don't know if they work. You don't know how firmly you actually believe in them. So that's why a lot of this is trial and error so far. Trial's going pretty well.
Yeah, no one's going to be too upset about taking 3 out of 4, even if there are some things along the way that were a little bit perplexing, or maybe not even perplexing. It's just so different compared to maybe what we had seen previously, what a Tito decision would look like. And it's unfair because Stephen Vogt is his own guy, but he's going to get compared to Tito for a long time. And he realizes that. And so I think it's natural to make those comparisons. Ooh, that's not something Francona would have done. Or that's exactly what Francona would have done. And I saw a couple of those things early. One, as he talked about Barlow, that he almost took the blame for him not looking sharp his first time out. And he said, well, it's because we didn't do a good enough job of making sure he was sharp. He didn't pitch. There's this long layover.
Hadn't pitched in a game in about a week.
That was so Francona. Yeah, how, yep. Instead of the players at fault, it's me. I put him in a bad situation. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have run him out there. And this is where I was a little bit curious. In his decision-making today to go to Barlow for a second inning, I don't know, you're thinking, well, there could be extra innings looming in the bullpen. It's not like it's been beat up. It's the first series of the season, but you want to be careful. You don't want to run guys out there too much. And so I thought that it probably, maybe it's not even a move that he would make in June and July when everybody's operating where they need to be. But the Barlow decision to take him back out there for another inning and then things crumbled away late, that was a thing that I was at least wanting to hear more of his decision-making on why he got there, because we knew what Terry Francona was going to do. We knew every response. I don't know those for Stephen Vogt yet.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, too, he's trying to navigate through the first part of the schedule where they have 8 straight games, and especially pitchers, you've maybe gone back-to-back once or twice. And it's hard because in spring training, that's once or twice in a controlled environment. You know you're pitching back-to-back. Here, you've no idea. You don't know if you're going to need to warm up 3 days in a row, warm up twice in one game. You've no idea. So I think the challenge here, because you're so used to, you play opening day, then you get a day off, then you go to a new city, and it's the same thing, and they don't have that. And it's not even an excuse. It's just, I think there is a lot more caution and care for, I mean, you saw Josh Naylor sit game 3 of the season, and that's because they're playing 8 in a row. He doesn't want Josh Naylor playing 8 in a row right out of the chute. So that was the day that he thought, you know what, let's get him a day off his feet, lefty on the mound, Fries hit well, there you go. So it's interesting. I'm with you. I every day I feel like we learn more and more about this guy. You know, they have a championship belt. I think it's Fanatics is selling these. They're like $500. It's your World Wrestling Championship belt. It's got a big Guardians logo in the middle. And Tyler Beattie bought one and brought it to the clubhouse. And they hand it to the player of the game after each game. I think it's Beattie, Hedges, and maybe Tristan McKenzie or the WWE board, the Linda McMahon, if you will, of this team, and they'll hand it out. So Stephen Kwan got it Saturday. He hit that home run. Friday, it was Andrés Giménez who got on base 5 times. The opener, Bieber, obvious answer, right? So they award it to Bieber. Bieber says no. Give that to Steven Vogt. It's his first win as manager. He's back here in Oakland where he was a hero. So they bring it to Steven Vogt, and Steven Vogt says, no, this is a player award. This is not for the manager. And look, maybe most managers would do the same thing in that situation. It eventually wound up with David Fry, who was 3-for-4 that day.
And legend has it, they're still arguing to this day.
Yeah,
it's like
the WCW belt going from like Goldberg to Sting to David Arquette. But
so Vogt just the finger poke of doom. He just laid down.
but it does show you that. And again, this doesn't mean that they're going to win 100 games this year, but you do see certain parallels between the two managers in terms of care and compassion and personality, where he said, look, it's not about me. It's about the players. This is an award for the players. This is something Beatty said. They did these things in San Francisco where they had the belt. They had fog machines. They had those guns that spray fake money. And after every win, they're going nuts.
Is there fake?
Because it's hard to win a game, and you should celebrate it and enjoy it, even if only for a few minutes. And so he wanted to bring the same thing here, and I think Vogt could have very well stood up in the middle of that clubhouse Thursday night and been like, this is my first win. Like, thank you. Shower me with adoration and praise and kudos. Maybe there was a little bit of that, not him saying that, but them wanting to toast to it. But he wants it about the players. And I think that's something that was ingrained in us with Tito, where he was never going to say anything bad. He was going to talk about how hard everybody worked. And I think Vogt's the same way.
The second thing that I noticed, as you've sort of alluded to, Tito loved to get everybody into that first series, everybody be playing. You wouldn't have a guy that's sitting there that didn't play that first weekend. You just want everyone's feet to be wet. In Oakland, unfortunately, that is often literal. So it was
a lot of leaks.
It was, including in the infield late in the game. There was a lot of maneuvering in and out. We saw even in the opener, there was no, typically we'd have this lefty lineup up there, but it's opening day, so we don't have our regulars in. He played the game like, we're trying to win this game. And that meant, I think, some confusion among followers of the team. Not those that have been paying attention, but maybe those a little bit more casual. Why is Fry in here in a pivotal spot in the lineup? Or why Laureano third? And that made so much sense to me. And I think it was cool and refreshing to see that he wasn't going to shy away from, this is going to be the lineup that we use on any particular day to beat that pitcher. Now you're going to balance that in terms of making sure everyone's fresh. As you said, you're making Josh Naylor sit a game at the outset. I don't think, you know, some of the lineup choices 3 games into the season are indicative of what Steven Vogt wants to do. But I found those parallels to be similar between what he and Tito would do and how he's balancing center field playing time. You know, that's interesting too, something we're going to continue to follow. You said Laureano started today more of a familiarity because of the sky in center field being a problem with the sun in Oakland. I'm curious how this is going to go. And we are going to learn so much over the next several weeks and months with Vogt, how willing he's going to be to ask guys to do different things on different days. That's not something that this team wanted to do. Oftentimes, Tito wanted a guy to be in that lineup spot and know he's going to be there every single day. That hasn't been the case. Even Jose, he's hitting second against the lefties. He's hitting third against the righties. And they're not shying away from the fact that we think the lineup is better when Jose is in the three spot against righties. Like it or not, that's what they've done to begin the year.
Yeah, there's so many young players, position players, especially on this roster, that you have to put them in positions where they might not have a ton of experience or comfort or track record, let's say. But you have to test things out to see if they work. Tyler Freeman went from learning center field in Arizona, where the sun is crazy, the air is different, and we've seen players completely flounder, to starting in center field, where it's so spacious in Oakland, and it's so windy, and for two of the games, there was like a driving rain or mist. I mean, that is not an easy situation to be put in. But it should make it easier when he goes to somewhere more normal, Minnesota or Cleveland, even Seattle. It was refreshing seeing him start in center for three straight days. And I've liked the way he's mixed in Arias and Rocchio. He got Fry in there. I mean, there were times when young players would sit for a while, and then you'd wonder, well, how are they ever supposed to build momentum at the plate? How are they supposed to get in a groove? And how are you supposed to learn about them? And I think part of it was the pressure to win immediately. I can empathize with that. You know, you feel like you can't toy around too much because if it costs you a game, like, you can't afford that. And that should still be the case, but I think this is a nice... It's just... I don't know. We need a longer look because four games in Oakland isn't going to tell us the full story. But I do like the way that they've worked everybody in and they've rotated and everyone's getting opportunities. I mean, everybody played multiple times. That's how it should be because you've got to learn about so many people at once. And there are more people to learn about who aren't even here yet. So I think this was a good omen, and they should have done more of this last year, but obviously after 2022 they felt the pressure to win right away and probably felt like they couldn't afford to try to trust things that maybe they didn't trust.
Even in the case of Florial, he has a tough day. It doesn't really put together great at bats, but then you come back later in the series and you see glimpses of why you don't want to run away from him. You want to make sure you give him some opportunity, because yeah, he hits the ball hard, and then he's on third base with that incredible speed for a big dude to be moving like he is. It's kind of fun to watch. See him steal a base. Those are elements of, even if he's not a starter for you, he can help you. Coming off the bench, doing that sort of thing, coming in late, stealing a bag, all of those things can help. So you're right. We should already be so much further down the road on so many of these players. Maybe it's shortstop. That's a good indication because you played Ahmed Rosario there for way beyond when you should have last year, and we should know more about Arias and Rocchio than we do. But okay, but we're in this position now. So how do you continue to learn about them? How are they all going to maintain their spots on the roster? And I like so far where we're at. Rocchio looks like he's been deserving of that time, the majority of the time at shortstop. He's shown us some glimpses of some extra base hits. That's great. I'm liking that he's bringing that element. What they've done with Freeman, I'm so pleased with how he played center field. Did not look out of place at all. Didn't look even remotely uncomfortable out there. It wasn't even a case of, like, the glove is shaking as he's making the play. Dude looked like a center fielder. And to the credit of the coaches, it looked like everyone around him also had prepared themselves. Kwan, whoever was playing right field, Brennan, in some instances, they're coming over to help him when they feel like they might need to. It's not like anything, we've learned anything of any sort of significance in Oakland, but it's a good first step on learning some important lessons on some key players. And oh, by the way, they helped you win some games. I'll take that too.
Yeah, if they would have come back and won on Sunday, what would the show have been? Just, they're going to the World Series? Road to the parade?
Yeah.
Reporting live from the first leg of the 7-month-long parade, I'm Zach Meisel with Channel 5. So Freeman told me he's almost scared how much he enjoys playing the outfield because he played infield his entire life, and he loves the outfield so much he can't believe it. So he said he loves, because he just loves running. Go chase down a fly ball. In the infield, you have 0.3 seconds to react to the chopper coming your way. In the outfield, go get it. That sounds like fun.
It's been there his whole life. It's like the significant other that you guys went to school together forever, and then finally, late in life, you discovered, whoa, we actually really like each other. playing center field. To his credit, the way that he took after it with so much emotion in spring that he looked like he wanted to do it. And whether he believes what you said or has just convinced himself of it, I mean, that's great to hear. But also on top of that, as we said all throughout spring training, the most important thing is he hitting? And whoever's playing that role or whoever is seeking the at-bats needs to hit and then find a way to make it work. And the good thing is he's shown us some of the hitting in the first, well, now three games for him, but the first four games of the series. I love that whether it was Rocchio, whether it was Freeman, you're seeing at least a little bit more punchy offense than we saw throughout lots of last year. That gets me a little bit excited to continue to see more. Not that it's an answer, but just four games into the season, it's what I got. Give me more.
Yeah, I think the thing to monitor, and it's funny, it should have been so hard to hit a home run here the entire series. It's that type of chill. It's almost like a fall chill. It feels like a late October day every day where I just know if I'm swinging a bat and I make contact, that's going to sting like a mother. And so naturally, what was it, Friday? I think I said that was the day where it was raining. It was, the wind was blowing in and the flags were just going nuts. And I said, there's no one who's hitting one out today. This is just, these conditions are brutal. You don't even want to make contact. About 45 seconds later, Jose Ramirez lined one over the fence. So, one, Mizel Jink still intact. Had quite a few reminders of that this weekend. But two, the main thing here is, like, that's great. Like, they strung together a bunch of singles and doubles. They ran the bases aggressively. All the things that fueled them 2 years ago. The question is that just because Oakland's pitching is bad and they had good batting average on balls in play fortune? Or, and I asked Kwan this, and he said, I think this was a good, like, his home run. I said, is that you doing exactly what you set out to do, where it's in an advantageous count, take a more aggressive swing and see what happens? And he said, I think so, but let's not let one result maybe dictate that this is working, this new approach. And that's what I think we need to learn more about with the offense is, are the exit velocities up? Are the number of at-bats where it's a first pitch or second pitch, they're making contact, but it's not the kind of contact you want, and they're rolling over and making a weak out? We need more evidence, and you need more evidence outside of Oakland. But there was a lot of solid contact by guys who maybe that's not their strength in the past, and you just need to see more of it. But I think good signs here. It's just,
yeah,
you don't want to just replicate 2022. If that's your style of play again, that's fine. But make it your style of play because you're hitting the ball with more authority when you're in position to do so, not just, hey, let's just make a ton of contact and try to be slap hitters who get good bounces.
Yeah, kind of to that point, look at Andrés Giménez. There were times, and he did have some real small spurts where he was better, but it really looked like all year long, he never really caught fire and looked completely comfortable the way that he had through so much of 22. What are four games in Oakland going to show us? Not a lot. The pitching, yeah, of course. Oakland doesn't have great pitching. But at the same time, the starters they ran out there are just like the average starter you see all the time throughout the season. I'm at least take care of business against them. Yeah, we don't know if they're going to handle the top third pitchers in the league, but at least show me you can go out and beat your league average starters or somewhere around there.
They whacked two soft-tossing or softer-tossing lefties. They've yes, never done that.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I mean, I've seen enough games in Oakland of them struggling against these sorts of pitchers to look for any sorts of positives. But Giménez in particular, I don't know, watching it, for me, I felt like he looked like he had so much more of an aggressive plan. And not that he is aggressive, but that he looks like he's up there to do something and he wants to execute that plan. As opposed to, there were times, and he can use the bunt as a weapon. And we saw him try to do that. We've seen Kwan do that, to people's dismay, to begin the season by starting the season with a pop-up bunt. Giménez can use the bunt as a weapon, but at times he was almost using it as like, I don't know what else to do. Just, I'm going to lay one down and maybe I'll accidentally get on first base. It'll be placed properly. He looked like he was up there with so much more of a plan and a confidence. And of course, when he starts to have some confidence or have some production, I'm sure that just builds on the confidence. I tweeted it. Man, there are so many key players on this team, but I don't feel like outside of health, there was a more critical player to this team, maybe McKenzie too, that getting back to what they were in 22 just lifts you immensely. Jimenez being that sort of force where he's not hitting second and fifth because you don't have anybody else to do it and he's okay, he's a league average bat. You're hitting him second and fifth or anywhere else in the middle of the lineup because that guy is a force offensively. And if what we saw this weekend in Oakland is any sense of what this season is going to be for him, boy, I can't wait to see it because we know the defense is going to be there. We know the speed is going to be there. And I know my war draft is going to look a hell of a lot better if Andrés Giménez is having that sort of season.
Sure sounds like the Seagulls agree with you. They thought that was a very astute point.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Yeah, we've already seen him make how many effortless highlight reel plays defensively. It feels like he had 12 diving stops in the hole with a throw to first to get a guy out that he had no business getting out. It's been four games. Yeah, offensively, I asked him for a self-evaluation of last season because I was curious how he thought it went. Obviously, he was the best defender in the league, and he was about league average offensively after a hot end to the season. It seemed like he wasn't really sure how to answer it, which I thought was fitting because I didn't really know how to answer that either. And he wanted to be more consistent this season. That's a vague way of saying, I think, just coming to the plate with the mindset of being the aggressor every time. You hinted at it. There were times where he just felt like he was defensive at the plate. And instead of, he was just trying not to make an out instead of trying to get a hit, if that makes sense. And he wasn't like that 2 years ago. I think maybe a little in the beginning, just being sort of tentative as he tried to flush 2021. But he was so consistent 2 years ago. His average never dropped below, I think, 280. His OPS was like 760 or higher the whole season after day one. So I think what made him so great and so important was how reliable he was. He'd play every day. He could hit lefties and righties. Obviously, defensively, you're not thinking twice about him. But you can hit him second. You can hit him third. You can hit him wherever. And you want him up at the plate when there's an important at-bat to be had. And if he can get back to that place where you want him getting as many trips to the plate as possible, the difference between a guy who builds a gaudy war total because he's so good defensively or a guy who builds an MVP caliber war total because he's as well-rounded a player as there is in the game, that's a big difference. And he's shown that the latter is in there. So, yeah, if they can get that from him, it changes a lot, too. You know, it's helps Jose Ramirez, Josh Naylor, and it gives Steven Vogt a guy he doesn't have to. I know he hates the word platoon, but you don't have to think like that. Like, no. He's in there every day no matter what.
Yeah, lefties, righties, it's not going to matter. And we touched on this at the end of the year, I believe. What took Jimenez at second base from being really good defensively to the best defensive player in the game To me, it looked like just him embracing that and knowing I'm a bad man on defense. I am going to make some spectacular plays, and I'm going to be happy about it. And you're going to be real pissed off as you go back to the dugout. And that's just who I am. I'm that dude defensively. And it seemed like when he started to embrace that he could make those sorts of highlight level plays. I don't know if that's tangible at all, but man, it seemed like that elevated him. And towards the end of the year, he was making those plays and embracing it. Like, yeah, I did that. And I'd love to see him just bring some of that to the offensive side. To, as you said, not feel like you're avoiding an out, but I want to be up. I want to be up in this situation. I don't want to take the hit by pitch. I'll take it because I'm going to get hit 50 times or climb the franchise leaderboard here. I will take those because I know pitchers are trying to get me out by busting me inside, but I want to be up. I want to do damage. You know, we've seen Jose go through stretches like that where he doesn't want to take the walk. He wants to swing the damn bat. And yes, that can be a detractor too if you let that too much of that enter your game plan. But for Jimenez, we know he's not going to take a ton of walks. Be aggressive. And when you get that pitch, get after it. And I just feel like for as much as you can learn in four games, he just looks like more of that guy. It's just got me so excited.
You know what we haven't seen in a long time? Is Jose Ramirez at the plate with runners on base constantly in front of him. Where it's not... Patience is not the issue with him because the pitcher has no choice. They've got to throw strikes. And so you're not worried about Jose getting himself out because he feels like he desperately needs to swing at things that he shouldn't. And so if you get Kwan and Jimenez in front of Jose and they're constantly reaching base, just think about what that could do for Ramirez. Because I don't think we've seen that. You know, whether it was Ahmed Rosario hitting second sometimes or Miles Straw leading off the year before that or... I don't even remember the 2020. I mean, like Kipnis was in that mix. I don't know. Delino DeShields Jr. Did he ever hit in front of Jose? Feels like something that would have happened. Because if it were up to me, I think Jose Ramirez should hit second, and he's doing that against lefties. But if Jimenez is 2022 Jimenez, I can live with him hitting in front of Jose.
Yeah, I'm just going to be anxious for him to get as many plate appearances as possible. And if you feel like it's best for your balance, I won't argue too much about it. Because the best thing to me is just making sure your best guys are near the top of the lineup. You don't need to have an Ahmed Rosario type in the second spot just because, right. Well, he's fast and he puts the ball in play and he's sort of an action player. No.
Oscar Mercado.
Yeah, put a guy up at the top of the lineup strategically because we want this guy to hit a lot. And I'm hopeful that Jimenez is that guy. On the other side of things, I'm anxious to see Bieber pitch a lot because if we see more of what we saw on opening day, my God, I am excited. Now, I know there was some wet blanket talk of, well, if you look at the stuff plus, it wasn't that great. A lot of that comes down to the changeup. And I'm wondering... Initially, the changeup confused a lot of people because of the velocity. It looked like you thought, is that a bad fastball, bad velo fastball? No,
it's actually... It confused Baseball Savant. The game right. feed was clocking him as fastballs at first.
Right, so you're like, how is this guy on one hand throwing 93, 94, but then here comes this other one in at 90, 91? But how... But then you saw him actually throw it, and you saw the grip, and you said, okay, that's clearly not a four-seam fastball. He's going with the changeup. Now, is that pitch going to, by itself, become a lethal pitch? I don't know. We made the joke that he's been chasing after that changeup for years and years at this point.
He made the joke, too.
Right. He knows
it. He said a decade. I think it's only been 7 years.
He knows it.
Only.
But why is he throwing that? Because he wants to... We talked about this with Savali for a couple of years. His arsenal, not any one pitch was so lethal that, oh my God, always focus that. Though the breaking pitch was pretty good for Savali. You wanted to throw a lot of them because the more pitches you can throw at average or better, it's more of a problem for the hitter to know what the heck is going to come. Not only in the pitch, but where you're going to throw it in the location. And if Bieber feels more confident about being able to attack every element of that strike zone, every quadrant of the zone, because he's got a pitch that can go any direction, that's just going to, on top of throwing with more velocity, by the way, which might be the most important thing, It doesn't have to be just about the pitch, but just throw it enough to give hitters another two strikes. Oh my God, I got to worry about this changeup 10% of the time. What the hell am I going to do up here?
Exactly. So he's got the curveball that goes like that, the slider that goes like that, fastball.
Please be on YouTube, because otherwise.
And now he's got the changeup that goes like that. But the difference here and the reason why it might work is it's a very different changeup to what he has thrown in the past. And to be able to throw the changeup, he needed the extra fastball velocity. If you are throwing a 90-mile-an-hour fastball, throwing a 90-mile-an-hour changeup is not going to be a good pitch. So the changeup at that speed, I think he threw one that was 91. He used to throw like 86, 88. Now it's more like Austin Hedges even said it's not too different than a splitter or a sinker. And it's just a matter of, it's the one pitch he's got that just fades instead of cuts. And so he would throw the cutter in a lot to lefties. Now he's got a changeup he can throw low and into righties. And if you're sitting 93, 94 even, and you're throwing a fastball, let's say at the knees on the inside corner, and then you throw a changeup at 89, 90 at that same place, and it fades at the end, that's how you get hitters to swing on top of it. So you're right. This should not be a pitch he throws 30% of the time. And it's, I think what happens here is it gives him conviction to throw everything. He doesn't have to rely too much on the curveball, too much on the cutter slider. He can be so diverse with what he throws. He can throw, I mean, he didn't throw very many curveballs the other day. And that used to be his best pitch. It's a pitch he said he feels better with now because he changed his grip. So there's a lot of ways he can go. And maybe he focuses on one thing one start and then leans on something else another start. A lot of it might depend on the scouting report, the matchup. But yeah, the velocity increase opens the door for a lot of different things here. And I think you saw a little taste of that the other night. And that's why it's also, you can't just say, well, it's Oakland. Well, no, I mean, if you look at the way he used pitches and the swings, that's the big thing. I mean, it's one thing to go six innings against Oakland and give up four hits and strike out three. And it was just, well, I had good command and they didn't hit the ball hard. His average exit velocity, even in his 2020 season, his exit velocity allowed was about league average, maybe a little better. And it was league average the other night. Last year, he was like in the bottom 2% of the league in exit velocity allowed. So yes, that is, Oakland's hitters aren't great. Maybe they're not making hard contact. Fine. But this would have been one of his best starts last year in terms of limiting hard contact. And then you include the fact that he got 11 strikeouts. And I think his whiff rate was like 45%. Like, those are signs that it's not just Oakland. It's, this dude has better stuff. And he threw with more conviction, and his command was great. So, again, let's see what it looks like against Seattle. Let's see what it looks like against Minnesota, or, well, Chicago. But I think maybe the Yankees after that, would he face? So, there will be more tests, but that was as encouraging of a first start as you could have had. I don't care who it's against. Like, if he pitches well against fourth graders, that's not a bad thing. If he got lit up by fourth graders, you'd be pissed and you'd be calling for him to be released.
Now you all are in big, big trouble. Sorry, that's Billy Madison. He has to feel confident.
I've seen that movie.
Every team, I have the arsenal to beat them. And I think just adding another pitch like this, as you said, does it mean he's going to throw it 35, 40% of the time? Not necessarily, but there might be starts where it calls for it. And even you might go in with a game plan of, hey, we're going to feature four seamers, cutters, and but you see the game plan the hitters have, and you say, we're in the second inning. We got to adjust because they're ambushing what I thought was going to be a good game plan here. And so just having more ways to get hitters out, giving them something else to think about, and having the confidence. You know, you have some success with it. We talked about it when we initially had the show joking about the changeup, that sometimes I wonder, Is it a good pitch? But you just, because you're such a perfectionist, you never stick with it long enough for it to gain any sort of traction. Maybe this is a case where he can just stick with it for a little bit, and maybe it's going to get beat up a little bit. Maybe it leads to some contact. But I think staying committed to it enough that it serves the purpose of why you introduced it, why you want it to begin with. And I think that's really important for him.
They need their rotation to be not just good, but great if they're going to contend. And to be great, I don't think they're – I think Bieber has to be better than he was last year. I don't know that he needs to be, as Austin Hedges called him, an ace among aces. But they need him to be really good. And you're not looking to make any sweeping declarations at this point in the season. That's not what this is. That's why we've had cautious optimism throughout this podcast. But with him, you're looking for signs.
Full on optimism. That's what give the people what they want.
You're looking for good signs or bad signs.
Yeah.
And I think Bieber was about as brilliant as you could have hoped for.
Generally, I just find it more enjoyable to try to look through a lens. Wait, it wouldn't be a lens that's glass half full, but a glass half full positive lens.
I just lenses are in your glasses, right?
It's more enjoyable for me to just be cautiously optimistic about a lot of things. I'm glad you brought up Hedges, because I found what he said after the game really interesting. Now, everyone was a little bit upset that he was in the opening day lineup. Of course, he leads to runs. Somehow he generates it, even if he has to use a thigh to make it happen, whatever. But I found it interesting because he took a year away. He wasn't with the team last year. He comes back. And so what he had envisioned Bieber to be, you know, have that in your head. And then you come back and you see what he is now. And he talked about how, didn't he say he feels like Bieber is more of a pitcher? He's pitching, so he's now got the stuff, but also the idea of how to pitch as well, and it's coming together here for him. And that's part of what he found enjoyable behind the plate in this particular game.
Yeah, I remember after the playoff start against Tampa, where Bieber was magnificent, and Hedges caught him, and they just kept giving each other credit. I just remember Bieber talking about how Hedges is so good behind the plate, leading him through a game. And I remember Hedges talking about how Bieber is just such a great pitcher in general and had reinvented himself with his diminished velocity, et cetera, et cetera. And Bieber didn't have that last year. And I know Stephen Vogt doesn't believe in personal catchers. And if you're a great pitcher, you should be able to work with any catcher. But I think them being reunited helps. Hedges knows him so well, and he's seen so many iterations of Bieber. I mean, he was catching sparingly in 2020 after the trade, but he had a front row seat to 5 or 6 weeks of Bieber being at the top of the world. He saw him the next year look really good again and then get hurt. He saw him the next year fight through different stuff and have to lean on different pitches and still be an ace. And you're right. He didn't see him last year when he just looked different and was getting hit really hard. I'm sure he watched video of it, spotted differences. But I remember him telling me in spring training, like, we can't just be fastball curveball like you were back in the day. And you can't just be cutter slider. You have to lean on all of them enough to keep the hitters guessing. Because his stuff was so good in 2020, and Carl Willis said this, that everyone in the world knew when he got to two strikes, he was throwing a curveball. No one could touch it. And I don't think his curveball is that curveball anymore. So you have to be more unpredictable.
Or at least not set up in the same way.
Right. You have to be more unpredictable. And Hedges has seen enough of him over the years to know how to be unpredictable. So I think that tandem works. I'll be curious to see. I know what Vogt said, but you know, who's catching Bieber in start two and start three?
I mean, I get selfish. I think, but I'd like to see Logan Allen with Austin Hedges defensively. I'd like to see Carrasco with Austin. who wouldn't I want to prefer to see the defensive side with Hedges? That's why they brought him back. He can be as bad as he is offensively, and he still keeps getting jobs because he's that good defensively. He's that good at bringing the best out of a pitcher, knowing the right things to say to a pitcher, being the psychologist and the psychiatrist. I don't know what all the, sorry. But also being really good defensively and framing and hopefully blocking and throwing and all the other elements that makes him a great defensive catcher.
We also should probably trust the manager with how to handle Bo Naylor and the catching position in general.
Maybe.
You know, the guys making the decisions were all catchers. And they're going to have a better handle on this than we are.
Let me ask you.
And that's not my typical stance. Typically, I don't say, hey, just trust the coaches because they know more than we do. But in this instance, we don't know exactly how this is going to work. We don't know how many games Bo Naylor is going to catch.
Yeah.
But they have a better idea of how to get a young catcher through 162 games than I would.
Yeah.
And that's their area of expertise.
I mean, I get it to some extent. I mean, a little surprising not seeing Naylor in there in the first game. But when I
are you trying to have opening day pageantry or are you trying to win a game? And if you thought Hedges gave you the best chance of winning that night, then you play him.
No, what I was going to say is I follow the bouncing ball here. I understand the thought process. And if you're going to let Hedges catch two of the games, they're going to be the games that the lefty's starting. It sets up the rest of the lineup. I don't want it to be just the lefty's on the mound, so you got to keep Naylor on the bench. But as you said, this is about not just Naylor performing well in the first opening weekend here. You want him to get the majority of your playing time. And I think because they also have the DH rotating at least initially, you could be aggressive there, where even if O'Reilly's on the mound, Naylor should still be in there as your DH on those games. I think you can still get him in the lineup even on the days that he's not catching. You have to ask, though, the catcher's something I've been thinking about. So, you know, when they bring a catcher in here as your manager, I think the early thought is, well, that makes it easier because he understands everything I'm going through. He can sympathize with my position. But I'm wondering, is there another side of this coin where how many times does a catcher get out of doing certain things because you just use a catcher excuse? And Stephen Vogt can be like, come on, man. I wrote that excuse. You're not going to tell me, oh, this is hurting. I got really got to focus on some. I know, dude. You can't pull that over.
It's not you. It's me. I invented it's not you. It's me.
That's what I mean. All right. Final thing. Before we wrap things up, bullpen usage was curious, but also largely probably dictated by the fact that you're opening up the season and you don't want to put too much on any one individual person. What did you take away from his bullpen usage?
It's a lot of Eli Morgan.
Not always in the strike zone.
Nothing really caught my attention, honestly. Class A the ninth. Barlow the eighth.
Good, because I've got 700 notes on it.
Hunter Gattis seems to be right in front of them.
Ding, ding, ding.
But I kind of thought that was going to happen all along.
Well, right, but I didn't see him shy away. Like, Heron was up a lot.
Yeah.
Gattis was up. Now, you could say, guys, this is just the state of the bullpen here. Your regular guys, the guys you'd count on, are not available, whether they're not going to be available at all this year or not for a long time or in Hench's case, maybe not for a little bit. So what other option does he have than to pitch Heron and to pitch Gattis and to pitch Cade Smith? But it didn't look like he was shying away from it. Wasn't a, well, wait till this game gets out of hand. No, these games were still hanging in the balance, and Heron's up throwing and Gattis in the middle of games while they're still yet to be decided. And then, of course, you get to Cade Smith, and that was fun. Just seeing five strikeouts in your debut. And you made the joke about his name, so if you want to throw that out there, that's...
No, it was our buddy Matt Derry who texted me, K-D-Smith, Cade Smith.
So you just texted me that without actually giving the proper credit.
Yeah, because I knew you'd mention it on the podcast, so I know you by now.
Okay.
And then I could give him credit on the podcast where I know he'll hear it. So in keeping with the theme of what are we learning about the manager? He has made a big point to say he wants versatility in the bullpen. He wants to be able to call upon Cade Smith in a 9-run game. And also if the game goes 11 innings and he needs another reliever in a tie game. So I think you're going to see guys pitch in different situations. But nothing really surprised me. I don't know. The guys who you thought would pitch it, they're also, two of the games weren't close, and the third one they were trailing the whole way till the end. So it's not like there was, you know, this wasn't like last year. I mean, how about that? I would have thought if they went 3-1 this series, it would have been 3 one-run wins, and then they would have lost the way they lost on Sunday. But that didn't happen. So I think, to me, it's more who has staying power when Hentges comes back, or when they have a game where the starter goes two innings and they got to send someone like Cade Smith down because he's got options and call somebody up. Like, is it Cade Smith? Is it Tim Herron? Has Hunter Gaddis, can he cement himself so it's not him? I mean, that's where it's going to get interesting. What happens when Lively and Curry are ready? So this is going to be fluid, I think, but I think he's going to want to make sure, whether it's Eli Morgan or Nick Sandlin or Hunter Gaddis, he can trust these guys in high leverage.
You made it, dude. You didn't get attacked. I am shocked.
Zach Meisel reporting here for the last time ever from the Coliseum.
Wow.
Back to you in the studio, TJ. How was that?
That was good. That was good. I had this conversation many times over the weekend. I do feel really bad for the fans in Oakland watching this all play out. It's just a total disaster how this is being handled. If you're confused why you're getting a free episode now, well, it was advantageous for you to see Zach Meisel, but also we're going to be messing the schedule around a little bit. We're not exactly sure, but we'll keep you up to date on when you can see the episodes drop. Make sure to get to patreon.com/selbyisguidecast, because we'll have more later this week. Bye, everybody.